Welcome to the September Dermatologic Surgery Digest podcast and Beyond the Digest supplemental podcast. I'm the podcast editor, Naomi Lawrence. In this month's podcast, I would like to focus on critical reading of the literature and the role of study design. I will use the first original investigation, electrodesiccation and curettage for squamous cell carcinoma in situ, to make a few key points. Dr. Erica Levitt does a wonderful job in summarizing the findings of this article. Some of the findings are a bit surprising, and so the article bears higher scrutiny. There were two findings that I found counterintuitive, the first being that larger lesions in immunosuppressed patients had no higher risk of recurrence. The second, that tumors in the M and H zones had no significantly different recurrence, and in fact, M-zone tumors had higher recurrence rate. Finally, the overall recurrence rate was lower than I would have expected at an average of 5.3%. As I have done other retrospective studies on cancer recurrence, I can tell you that it's a difficult task. In this study, the definition of recurrence was a cancer that was discovered in dermatologic skin cancer surveillance within the first 5 years and documented to be recurrence in the clinical documentation or by manual review of the photographic and clinical documentation. The issues with this is that the person performing the general skin exam is not specifically looking at the procedural site. So to note a recurrence, they would have to look back in the chart documentation and know that a procedure was done at that exact site and make a note of it. In each patient, there might be confounding lesions and scars from other procedures that would make this difficult to ascertain. Understanding how recurrence was defined makes it clear why the study design might underestimate true recurrence. In addition, in immunosuppressed patients who have multiple lesions, one might have greater difficulty identifying a recurrence unless someone is prospectively looking at one spot. Another aspect of the study is design that might have affected recurrence in the H zone is that they had no lesions on eyes, lips, and genitalia, as those were likely referred for Mohs. I point out these concerns to remind all of us that any article you read that potentially changes the way you practice should bear similar scrutiny. Thanks for listening and have a happy surgery day.
This segment of the episode features surgical oncology and reconstructive article reviews.
This is Erica Levitt reviewing the original article, Electrodesiccation and Curettage for Squamous Cell Carcinoma in Situ, The Effect of Anatomic Location on Local Recurrence by authors Kevin Vervurka and Eric Stratman. This was a retrospective single-center cohort study of squamous cell carcinomas in situ treated by electrodesiccation and curettage. The objective was to calculate the 5-year recurrence rate and to see if this differs by anatomic location. 510 SCCIS treated by ED&C were included in the study. Only tumors with at least 5 years of follow-up were included. The 5-year recurrence rate was 5.3%. 81.5% of which remained SCCIS rather than becoming invasive. The overall recurrence rate was 6.3% as there were 5 tumors that recurred after 5 years. Clinical size less than or greater than 1 centimeter and immunosuppression status did not significantly affect recurrence rate. The Mohs AUC anatomic location groupings H, M, and L were used to compare recurrence rates by body site. For their analysis, 134 L tumors and 134 M tumors were matched with 134 H tumors. The recurrence rate for the M group was 8.2%, for H tumors was 6%, and for L tumors was lower at 3%. This was not statistically significant, although the recurrence rate for M tumors became significantly greater than L tumors when the recurrences after 5 years were included. The authors theorize that the reason that the M grouping had higher recurrence rates than the H group could be that the M area includes high-density hair-bearing areas such as the scalp and beard area, which I think is reasonable. Overall, the study shows an overall 5-year recurrence rate for SCCIS treated with ED&C of about 5%, with a trend towards lower recurrence rates in area L and the highest recurrence rate in area M. The authors acknowledge that Mohs would likely offer a significantly higher cure rate than ED&C in areas H and M, and this study did not compare ED&C with Mohs surgery in terms of recurrence rates, cosmetic outcomes, or patient preference.
This is Deirdre Connolly reviewing the original investigation, Survival Outcomes and Prognostic Factors of Dermatofibrosarcoma Protuberans, a population-based retrospective cohort analysis. First author Shijin Chen, senior author Li Li. In this article, authors investigate the clinopathologic characteristics and survival outcomes of DFSP. The study cohort of 7,500 patients was selected from the SEER database from the year 2000 to 2018. Clinical pathologic variables, survival outcomes, and prognostic factors were analyzed. 75% of the tumors were cutaneous, while 25% were located in the soft tissue. The median follow-up of all patients was an impressive 92 months. Median follow-up times were similar between patients with lymph node and distant metastases. The median age at diagnosis was 42 years. Only 764 patients had histologic grade records, with 45% grade 1, 39% grade 2, and 15% rated grade 3 tumors. Approximately half of the patients had tumor size records with a median tumor size of 3 centimeters. Interestingly, the only significant difference between the skin and soft tissue DFSP groups was size. The soft tissue group had a slightly higher average size of 3.6 centimeters. At diagnosis, 0.17% of the patients had lymph node metastases and 0.54% had distant metastases. Only 6 of these patients had histologic grade criteria available for analysis. Surgery was the primary treatment for DFSP, even for patients with distant metastases. More than half of the cases underwent gross or radical excision, which is what authors term treatment with negative surgical margins, and approximately 1/3 underwent local destruction with positive margins. Only 1% and 6% of the patients received chemotherapy and radiotherapy, respectively. The 10 and 15-year DFSP specific survival rates were both 98%. The median survival time of the 89 patients who died of DFSP was significantly shortened to 41 months. Independent, these cases had significantly larger tumors, a median tumor size of 6.3 versus 3 centimeters, more grade 3 tumors, 55% versus 16%, and a higher proportion of males, 63% versus 47%. Specifically, patients with tumors greater than 10 centimeters in size or histologic grade 3 had significantly higher DFSP-specific mortality at 7% and 10%, respectively. Tumor locations and surgical procedures did not significantly influence survival. Overall, DFSP has a favorable survival prognosis, even in patients with node-positive or distant metastases. DFSP-specific mortality is significantly higher in patients with grade 3 or large greater than 10 centimeter tumors. One caveat here is that histologic grading was only represented in about 764 cases out of 7,500 studied, so the data is lacking in this regard.
This is Michael Renzi reviewing the original investigation reconstruction of high-tension scalp defects by the Twizzler technique, a retrospective case series by first author Alexandria Riopel and senior author Carl Schonbacher. The scalp's inelastic fibrous galea aponeurotica, tendency to undergo stretchback, thick cutaneous tissue, and convex landscape create a conundrum when attempting primary wound closure, requiring immense undermining or scoring of the galea to achieve even closure for even small wounds. One technique for attaining tissue approximation and linear closure in high-tension areas is with intraoperative mechanical creep or elongation of the skin beyond its intrinsic extensibility as a constant load is applied over time. In this article, the authors described the use of a stress relaxation technique, or the Twizzler, to achieve primary closure of high-tension scalp wounds after Mohs surgery. Over an 18-month study period, scalp defects unable to be repaired primarily with standard ellipse and extensive subgalear undermining were identified. These patients were then selected for the Twizzler scalp repair by the senior author. I would like to refer listeners to the article for the Twizzler procedure details. An excellent supplemental video of the procedure is also available. If postoperative photos at 3 months or later were available, these cases were then included in a cosmetic analysis by two independent surgeons who were not involved in the repair. The surgeons conducted an aesthetic review evaluating the final repair and long-term outcome on the Likert scale, with one representing a poor outcome and five representing an excellent outcome. Patients rated the outcome of their scar at 3 months or later with the Patient and Observer Scar Assessment Scale, or POSAS. During the study period, 15 basal cell carcinomas, 33 squamous cell carcinomas, 1 AFX, and 1 malignant melanoma in situ underwent skin cancer resection, followed by Twizzler repair, with 42 located on the vertex scalp and 8 on the parietal scalp. The mean maximum defect diameter was 2 centimeters, and the average final length of closure was 5.7 centimeters. 25 cases met inclusion criteria for physician cosmetic evaluation. Scalp reconstruction outcomes were rated as excellent or very good 60% of the time. The average cosmetic score was 3.71 out of 5. Track marks were detected 51% of cases, and hair loss was detected in 30% of cases involving hair-bearing scalp. 32 patients participated in the POSAS analysis, and most patients rated their scars as normal, near normal skin. Overall, I think this appears to be a viable time and tissue sparing closure for large wounds in high tension areas, and I look forward to more comparative studies going forward.
This is Jordan Lim reviewing the original article, Triple Therapy Protocol for Primary and Secondary Auricular Keloids, a Prospective Outcome Evaluation, by Frank Dadema, Joan Saradin, Ferdinand Timmer, Laura Rothusen, and Floris van Zylch. This is a prospective study from an ENT department at an academic teaching hospital describing the protocol triple therapy approach to treating auricular keloids. The protocol adapted from Brand and colleagues involves surgical removal followed by intralesional steroids and application of a custom pressure device. Phase 1 involves surgical resection and subsequent reconstruction with limited to no undermining, no coagulation, and tensionless closure with small monofilament non-absorbable sutures. This was followed by a small amount of intralesional 40 mg per milliliter triamcinolone. Sutures were removed after 10 days. Phase 2 repeated the intralesional triamcinolone injections beginning 4 weeks after surgery and repeating for up to 3 more injections at a 4 to 6 week interval. Judgment as to the necessity of the subsequent injections was based on visible or palpable residual keloid, recurrent keloid-associated symptoms, or onset of intralesional steroid side effects. Phase 3 commenced immediately after injections were completed by creating a plaster duplicate of the patient's ear by which a custom two-part acrylate pressure device was then created. I would refer the reader to Figure 2 for an image of the custom pressure devices. Patients were encouraged to wear the pressure device as much as possible, but at a minimum of 12 hours per day for 5 days a week. Regular follow-up visits allowed for adjusting of the device to ensure appropriate pressure was being delivered. Pressure therapy was completed when the scar matched the surrounding healthy skin level. 11 consecutive patients with 16 keloids were included in the study. 81.3% of keloids were recurrences, and the mean follow-up was 28 months. The number of triamcinolone injections varied from 2 to 5, and the duration of pressure therapy varied from 1 to 12 months. A complete response was noted in 93.8% of keloids, with good overall tolerance and compliance of the protocol. The authors suggest that this protocol for the compliant patient can be effective at reducing recurrences of keloids and can be utilized to avoid the last resort option of radiation therapy. The limitations of the study and protocol include the small patient cohort, availability of the expertise to create custom pressure devices, and ensuring patient compliance throughout this lengthy process.
This is Christy Regula reviewing the original article, Current Practice in Keloid Treatment, a Survey of Dutch Dermatologists and Plastic Surgeons, by first author Ki Yin and second author Oren Lipid. Keloids remain a difficult treatment challenge. There are numerous therapeutic options available, but it is unclear what the most commonly used treatments are. This study is a survey of dermatologists, plastic surgeons, and dermatology and plastic surgery residents in the Netherlands to better learn how keloids are treated. The survey consisted of four multiple-choice demographic questions concerning the participants' medical specialty, years of experience, practice setting, and number of keloid treatments per month. There were also nine multiple-choice treatment questions based on three different clinical cases. For each case, participants were asked about their first choice, second choice, and third choice of treatment. The first case was a small keloid, 15 by 10 millimeters on the left mandible. Second was a large 8x5 centimeter keloid on the mandible, and third was a patient with multiple keloids on the chest. 143 physicians responded to the survey. There was substantial heterogeneity in treatment preference for all three cases. For treatment of the small keloid, 66% chose monotherapy, with the most frequent first choice being intralesional steroids, with 71%. For treatment of the large keloid, 51% of respondents would not treat this keloid by themselves. Of those who would treat, 41% chose combination therapy. The most frequent first choice was intralesional steroids at 25%, primarily combined with other treatments, including cryotherapy and laser. Surgery with or without additional treatment was the first choice in 22% of participants. The most common treatments to combine with surgery were intralesional steroids or brachytherapy. For treatment of the multiple keloids, most, 58% of participants, chose combination therapy. The most frequent first choice was intralesional steroids with 47%. Other therapies combined with the steroids were cryotherapy, laser therapy, and verapamil. This study shows that keloid treatment is varied between specialists and that treatment preference is dependent on size and number of keloids. This is Christy Regula reviewing the reconstructive conundrum, reconstruction of a large upper lip defect by first author Aaron Roberts and senior author Stan Tokojov. This is the case of a 51-year-old woman with an infiltrative basal cell carcinoma on her left vermilion lip. The post-Mohs defect was 5.9 by 4.4 centimeters, invading the muscle. Large defects of the upper lip can pose reconstructive challenges considering the essential function of the mouth. In this case, a single-stage crescenteric Burrows advancement flap was used for repair, utilizing the tissue reservoirs of the medial and lower cheek. Subunit boundaries should be marked, and ideally incision lines should be placed there. In this case, two standing cones were removed. The first was a crescenteric excision between the vermilion and the drawn arch of the advancement flap, and a second Burrows triangle was excised along the marionette line. The flap is then advanced into the defect. If the mucosal lip is involved, as was in this case, a partial mucosal advancement or rotation can be done to align the vermilion. This case is a beautiful example of how this flap can work for a substantial defect, and there are several key points made by the authors. It is important to undermine in the subdermal fat on the advancing cheek. This prevents a bulky flap of fatty cheek from crossing the nasolabial fold and pushing down on the vermilion border. Deep tacking sutures from the advancing flap can be used to approximate a new nasolabial fold and to avoid pushing of the vermilion in a tight pull of the cheek skin across the upper lip. It's important to create an appropriate arc for the crescenteric Burrows advancement flap and enough length for the excised standing cone to allow full reach. For more details and photos of this case, please refer to the journal.
This is Michael Renzi reviewing the reconstructive conundrum repair of a nasal tip defect by first author Roya Nazarian and senior author David Shokan. The authors present the repair of a 2.5 by 2.5 centimeter defect down to perichondrium following two stages of Mohs surgery for a basal cell carcinoma on the nasal tip and supertip of an 87-year-old male patient. The authors chose to reconstruct the defect with a pedicled subcutaneous soft tissue flap, or SCSTF, using the nasalis muscle to replace lost soft tissue volume and provide a vascular bed on which a full thickness skin graft may be applied. The superior and right lateral boundary of the dorsal subunit were incised to the level of the nasalis muscle, and a flap of skin was raised from right to left to expose the underlying nasalis muscle. A triangular muscle flap was then undermined and mobilized from its proximal to distal edge by dissection in the subnasalis plane, taking care to maintain the attachment of its inferior pedicle to the underlying perichondrium approximately 3 millimeters above the superior edge of the nasal defect. The nasalis flap was then hinged 180 degrees into the primary defect to fill the internal nasal portion of the defect without tension and was secured with polyglactin 910. A full thickness skin graft was then taken from the posterior auricular area and placed into the primary defect above the SCSTF platform. Outcome at 9 months, 9 month follow-up can be seen in figure 4 of the article, and I would encourage listeners to go take a look at the photos. I think this is a great repair option for patients who decline a paramedian forehead flap.
This is Erica Levitt reviewing the communication Cutaneous Malignancy in Hidradenitis Suppurativa by authors Mustafa Jaffrey and Hazni Mohammed. This was a case report of a 49-year-old woman with Fitzpatrick skin type 5 who had a 6-year history of HS with involvement of the chest, groin, thighs, and perineum. She later presented with an eroded nodule on the left medial buttock that was initially treated with doxycycline and intralesional steroids, and once the lesion progressed into an ulcer with raised borders, was treated empirically as pyoderma gangrenosum. A biopsy then showed nodular melanoma with a Breslow depth of 4.3 millimeters, and inguinal lymph node biopsy confirmed metastatic melanoma. The patient unfortunately developed lung and brain metastases and is still undergoing treatment. In the literature review, the authors discussed studies from the Swedish National Cancer Registry finding that patients with HS have overall increased risk of cancer of all types, as well as increased risk of non-melanoma skin cancer specifically. Squamous cell carcinoma is the cutaneous malignancy most associated with HS, but there have been case reports of cutaneous metastases mimicking HS flares prior to this current case report of an aggressive melanoma mimicking an HS flare. Dermatologists treating HS patients should have a low threshold to biopsy non-healing HS lesions that do not respond to standard treatments or behave like the patient's other lesions.
This is Deirdre Connolly reviewing the communication, Basal Cell Carcinoma in the Mucosa of the Lower Lip, a Rare Location. First author, Adalberto Santana Gutierrez. Senior author, Jorge Ocampo Candiani. The authors present a brief communication of a rare case of superficial basal cell carcinoma of the lower lip mucosa. A 74-year-old gentleman presented with an ulcerated lesion on the mucosal surface of the lower lip. 3 years prior, a resected lesion in that same area was diagnosed as actiniculitis. Present biopsy was consistent with superficial basal cell carcinoma, and resection with clear margins was performed. Basal cell carcinoma arises from keratinocyte progenitor cells located in the upper infundibulum of hair follicles and sweat glands, and only a few cases of mucosal basal cell carcinomas arising from the vermilion lip and oral mucosa have been reported, and only 3 cases of lower lip basal cells confined to the oral mucosa have been reported in the literature to date. Hypotheses for how this might occur on a mucosal surface include tumor cells arising from primary epithelial germ, traumatic epithelial implantation, migration of pilosebaceous units, or ectopic sebaceous glands.
This is Jordan Lim reviewing the communication article titled A New External Device for Surgical Defects in Lower Legs by authors Beatrice Butron-Briss, Pedro Rodriguez-Jimenez, Elena Gallo, and Yolanda Delgado Jimenez. This is a prospective study utilizing the ABRA adhesive skin closure device for lower limb surgical defects. This device has been previously described in other specialties for difficult scalp and sternal closures. The authors present 15 consecutive cases utilizing the device compared to 15 retrospective controls. All patients had defects on the pre-tibial lower limb measuring between 2 to 3 centimeters. After the surgical defect was created, the device would be placed with adhesive pads 1 centimeter away from the wound edge on both sides of the ellipse. A silicone elastic cord called elastomers was then passed through loops in the adhesive pads and tied on top of the wound to approximate the wound edges. The defect was then sutured using only 3-0 polypropylene simple or mattress cuticular sutures. No intradermal sutures were placed. The device was removed after 5 to 7 days, then sutures were removed 10 to 15 days later. No oral antibiotics were provided. I would refer the reader to Figure 1 to fully appreciate the application of this device. There were 2 infections and 1 dehiscence in the experiment group, compared to 1 infection and 5 dehiscences in the control group. Mean follow-up time was 8.8 months, and overall function and aesthetic satisfaction was highly rated by the intervention patients. Authors suggest that this 60-euro device may alleviate the requirement for complex flaps or grafts and decrease the postoperative complications for large lower limb defects.
This segment of the episode features general dermatologic surgery and cosmetic article reviews.
I am Curran Lal, and I will be discussing intradermal delivery of alopecia therapeutics, current state and future prospects. Androgenetic alopecia is the most common form of alopecia, and while oral treatments have changed drastically over the past few years, they are limited by their potential systemic adverse events. Current developing trends include mesotherapy of minoxidil and 5-alpha reductase inhibitors such as dutasteride. This is currently being performed abroad with the goal of reducing potential systemic adverse events. This article revealed all applicable articles involving mesotherapy and androgenetic alopecia, alopecia, minoxidil, and dutasteride until September 2022. They identified 3 randomized controlled trials on intradermal dutasteride therapy. Studies assessing intralesional dutasteride demonstrated considerable subjective and objective benefits of dutasteride mesotherapy in male and female patients with androgenetic alopecia. Best results were achieved at a dosing of 1 to 2 milliliters of 0.05% dutasteride, with all studies starting at weekly injections for the first month, with varying schedules thereafter, and eventually subsequent monthly injections. No patients experienced sexual side effects, and no male patients in one of the studies noted any differences in semen volume, sperm concentration, sperm motility, or sperm morphology. 2 randomized controlled trials assessed intralesional minoxidil therapy with dosing schedules similar to that of the studies that looked at intralesional dutasteride. The studies used 0.5% minoxidil or 2% minoxidil, and no hypertrichosis was noted. Interestingly, they also looked at studies that evaluated Nutrient mesotherapy, and these studies did not show improvement over topical minoxidil with regards to hair density. While this is promising, remember this is not FDA approved, and these studies were limited in their sample sizes and follow-up time. 2 patients that were in the dutasteride therapy group did develop non-scarring alopecia due to ethanol being a solvent, which brings up an issue of formulation. We also do not know the appropriate dosing, treatment schedules, as well as sterility becomes an issue of these products that are being injected into the scalp. Vascular occlusion is possible, and that's why the solvent must be chosen appropriately.
This is Megan McLean reviewing the original investigation, Foam Sclerotherapy in the Treatment of Hemangiomas and Venous Malformations by authors Chenji Yang et al. The authors remind us that infantile hemangioma, or IH, has a prevalence rate of 4 to 10%, while venous malformation, or VM, has a prevalence of 1%. They are differentiated histologically by proliferating endothelial-like cells in IH and normal endothelial cells in VM. Pyogenic granuloma, or PG, is another common acquired vascular tumor. Foam sclerotherapy has become a standard treatment option for VM, however, it's been less used in IH and PG. This analysis sought to compare clinical outcomes and complication rates of foam sclerotherapy in the management of these 3 conditions. The authors analyzed the treatment of 122 patients, consisting of 28 patients with IH, 11 patients with PG, and 83 patients with VMs. The size of the IH in children was limited to 1 by 1 centimeter. The diagnosis of VM was established using duplex ultrasound, while IM and PG were diagnosed clinically. 1 to 3% polidocanol foam was produced using a 1 to 3 liquid to air ratio and injected with 25 gauge butterfly needles for IH and superficial VMs, or with 22 gauge needles under ultrasound guidance for deeper VMs. Treatments were repeated every 3 weeks as needed and photographs taken at each visit. Post-op evaluations were performed 3 and 6 months after the last treatment session. The average number of treatments was 2.64 for IH, 1 for PG, and 2.47 for VMs. Volume of foam sclerotherapy use tended to be higher in the VM than in the IH and PG group. A higher percentage of VMs required 3% rather than 1% polidocanol. 75% of IH, 91% of PG, and 67% of VM had satisfactory resolution 3 and 6 months after the last treatment session. There was no significant difference between the overall therapeutic effectiveness among the three groups. The proportion of VMs with fair and satisfactory resolution was not significantly different for depending on the different depths of tissue involvement. Painful swelling was the most common complication in 4 patients. One of these 4 patients developed blisters and epidermal necrosis in his index finger as a result. Please see text for additional breakdown of results. The authors concluded that despite the differing pathologies of these 3 vascular anomalies, they all responded comparably well to foam sclerotherapy with minor complications. This article was limited by small sample size in some of the groups.
I am Curran Lal, and I will be discussing bridging the gap sustained treatment effect of glabellar lines with twice-a-year treatment with doxybotulinum toxin A. There now exist 2 generations of botulinum toxins. First-generation toxins have patients on a 3 to 4 month schedule based on their duration of effect, whereas doxybotulinum toxin A has a median duration of 6 months, which theoretically allows patients to be uncorrected for a longer period of time. In turn, this allows for a more consistent result without a peak in a valley effect. The objective of this article is to discuss the number of days a typical patient treated with doxybotulinum toxin A for injection or a legacy botulinum products would spend undertreated or uncorrected in a given calendar year. For doxybotulinum toxin A for injection, the median duration of effect for maintaining glabellar lines in the none or mild severity range is 24 weeks or 168 days. Based on this data, the average patient treated with the approved 40-unit dose of doxybotulinum toxin A every 6 months would expect to be uncorrected for a total of only 29 days in a given calendar year. The median duration of effect for maintaining none or mild severity for onabotulinum toxin A has been reported to be 120 days, suggesting that patients treated with twice a year with 20 units of onabotulinum toxin A can expect to spend a total of 123 days with moderate to severe glabellar lines. Interestingly, many argue that the dose of doxybotulinum toxin A is double that of legacy toxins, but studies looking at higher dose of legacy toxins did not match the duration of effect of doxybotulinum toxin. Furthermore, the approved doses of onabotulinum toxin A and doxybotulinum toxin contain an equal amount of core protein, which is 0.18 nanograms, which implies that product formulation has some effect on clinical performance.
This is Isabella Jones reviewing Laser and Device-Assisted Filler Delivery, a Histologic Evaluation by Cervantes and Chung. In this study, the authors examined laser-assisted drug delivery in fresh, full-thickness human skin tissue from patients undergoing abdominoplasty. Specimens were treated with either a fractional blade of CO2 laser, a fractional microneedling device at 1.5 millimeters, or a microneedling roller at 2 millimeters. The exact device settings are described in the article, but immediately after treatment with each device, the authors applied polylactic acid at an 8 milliliter dilution, hyaluronic acid filler, they used Restylane L in this case, or calcium hydroxyapatite. Black tissue marking dye was also used as a control. Each combination was tested 3 times using 3 different donor patients. The results are displayed nicely in a table format, but to review, for the CO2 laser, the CO2 created channels that had an average width of 147.4 millimeters. PLLA almost always was seen throughout the channels, both superficially and deep. HA was occasionally seen in the specimens, calcium hydroxyapatite rarely, and then the marking ink was seen in all specimens at different levels. For RF microneedling, this produced columns of purplish coagulated collagen bundles from the papillary and in the mid-reticular dermis. Slit-like spaces in the epidermis from the needle insertion were only very rarely noted. and there was no evidence of dermal channels. And for RF microneedling, ink was not seen, let alone any of the fillers that were applied after the procedure. For microneedling, the microneedling roller, the width of the channels was measured at the DE junction at approximately 5.9 millimeters. And ink was occasionally seen, but they did not find PLLA, hyaluronic acid, or calcium hydroxylapatite. Overall, only the combination of CO2 and PLLA showed consistent device-assisted filler delivery in these specimens. In the discussion, the authors review prior clinical studies looking at laser-assisted drug delivery. Prior studies in humans have showed superiority of CO2 combined with PLLA over CO2 alone for atrophic scars, perioral wrinkles, and skin rejuvenation. One study on CO2 plus hyaluronic acid failed to show a statistically significant improvement in facial skin remodeling over CO2 alone, and they did not examine the tissue histologically. Another study looked at the treatment of acne scars by applying first poly-L-lactic and poly-D-lactic acid, followed by fractional RF microneedling. The acne scar assessment scores and patient satisfaction scores were better with the combination therapy. And histologic examination from two patients showed denatured columns secondary to the RF microneedling and polarized material in the reticular dermis. The authors conclude that clinicians need to be familiar with the size of the filler they are using and the width of the channels that they're creating using the device that they, you know, they are using in that patient. They point out that more studies need to be conducted to determine the best protocols. They also point out the weaknesses of their studies in that it was an ex vivo design. In vivo, significant tissue bleeding can potentially oppose the flow of fillers into the channels, and tissue elasticity could act to close these channels rapidly after lasers or devices. In addition, abdominal skin might react differently to laser-assisted drug delivery than the face. Finally, hyaluronic acid can be washed out during the tissue fixation. Thus, hyaluronic acid might be able to be delivered more frequently than was demonstrated in their study.
This is Monica Bowen, and I'll be reviewing the article, The Comparative Dermal Stimulation Potential of Constant Volume and Constant Amount Diluted Calcium Hydroxylapatite Injections versus the Concentrated Form by first author, Dr. Asinur Batsali, and last author, Dr. Erkan Kaliskan. Hyperdiluted calcium hydroxylapatite, or CAHA injections, have been used more frequently to stimulate collagen within the skin and not only for their volumizing potential. Similarly, hyaluronic acid fillers can cause neocollagenesis by increasing tension within the dermis, which is theorized to stimulate the activity of dermal fibroblasts. This study aims to evaluate the dermal stimulation potentials of different concentrations of CAHA injections. This was an in vivo study conducted on Yorkshire pigs where different dilutions of CAHA were injected into the skin and tissue samples were collected 4 months later. Histology showed that CAHA was detected in all injection sites, but in the control groups there was no inflammatory pattern. Fibroblast counts were higher in the more concentrated calcium hydroxylapatite dilutions, but even the hyperdilute concentration of 1 to 19 dilution of CAHA to normal saline still had more fibroblasts than the control, and similar patterns were shown for collagen density. Of note, the high dilution 1 to 19 was performed in order to demonstrate that even a low CAHA dilution could stimulate collagen. So this study shows that even at large dilutions of 1 to 19, CAHA can still have a biostimulatory effect. Fibroblast counts did decrease with increasing dilutions of CAHA, but an inflammatory pattern and increased fibroblasts and collagen density were detected.
The authors advise injection of hyperdelicaha in the subdermal plane at ratios of 1 to 2 for normal skin, 1 to 4 for thin skin, and 1 to 6 for atrophic skin. And once again, you can, when HAHA is hyperdiluted, you can avoid some of the nodule formations that can be present with a straight HAHA injection.
This is Megan McLean summarizing the review article, Photography and Image Acquisition in Dermatology, a Scoping Review, Techniques for High Quality Photography. The authors begin by discussing the importance of photography in dermatology while also highlighting shortfalls in our current photography training and protocols. A recent survey demonstrated that 74% of dermatologists desire more training in clinical photography. The goal of this review is thus to establish evidence-based recommendations for high-quality clinical photography. The study was conducted in accordance with PRISMA for scoping reviews. Eligibility criteria for provided studies are included in the method section of the text. The search was performed in Embase, Medline, PubMed, and evidence-based medicine databases. 10,696 articles were screened, with full text review of 236 and inclusion of 74 articles. Full text review and data extraction was completed by two individual reviewers. The authors provide a summary of different camera and setup elements that impact image quality in clinical photography. Table 1 provides a nice summary of the different camera types that may be utilized, including digital single light reflex or DSLR cameras, digital medium format cameras, point and shoot digital cameras, smartphone and tablet cameras, mirrorless cameras, and light field cameras. The advantages and disadvantages of each are summarized, as are the author's overall recommendations regarding camera choice. Table 2 provides a summary of tips and recommendations for other elements of high-quality images, including a discussion of resolution, lens types, automatic versus manual settings, as well as recommendations for lighting, background, camera and patient setup, and standardization of photography. Table 3 reviews the types of specialized clinical photography which are used in clinical dermatology. This includes 2D photography, 3D photography, parallel polarized light photography, which may enhance visualization of surface structures, cross-polarized light photography, which enhances visualization of subsurface structures, UV photography, and fluorescence photography, which can be used to monitor acne. The article overall includes a wide breadth of information related to clinical photography and would be a useful resource for anyone considering updating, changing, or optimizing their current clinical photography setup. The tables make quick references possible while the text provides more detail and clarity on the individual elements discussed.
This is Monica Bowen. I'll be reviewing a retrospective analysis of complications of minimally invasive cosmetic procedures seen at a referral practice in Houston by first author Dr. Taryn Murray and last author Dr. Paul Friedman. The authors performed a retrospective chart review of patients who had complications after minimally invasive cosmetic procedures and presented to their clinic in Houston, Texas over a 10-year span from 2012 to 2022. They found a total of 42 patients who were identified to have complications after minimally invasive laser procedures. The most common procedures with complications were tattoo removal, comprising 24% of the cases, laser resurfacing, comprising 24% of the cases, and laser hair removal of 21% of the cases. Complications were most frequently from a plastic surgery office and then medical spas, and the authors theorized that perhaps the plastic surgery offices were delegating to mid-levels for these procedures. And 42% of the complications were in skin of color patients, as practitioners may not be familiar with treating darker skin types. So this retrospective review gives an overview of the type of complications one may expect from outside clinics.
This is Isabella Jones reviewing fractional erbium YAG laser and 0.01% bimatoprost in leucoderma from iatrogenic melasma treatment in skin phototype 5 patient by Impanth and Weiss. The authors state this is the first report on the combination of treatment for leucoderma in melasma. A 58-year-old female with skin type 5 presented with a 10-year history of melasma and treatment-related leucoderma. The leucoderma failed to improve with topical tacrolimus and 7 sessions of fractional erbium YAG laser. The patient underwent an additional 7 sessions of fractional erbium YAG, followed by application of twice daily 0.01% bimatoprost solution to the depigmented areas. And on the melasma, they used 0.1% licorice PT40 cream and 5% AHA gel. After those additional sessions, photos show an impressive improvement of the leucoderma with no worsening of the melasma and a 70% improvement in melasma severity score from baseline. This is Isabella Jones reviewing composite grafting to avoid excessive tension after removing too wide a donor strip in follicular unit strip surgery by Jay Park. The author described 7 patients who underwent follicular unit strip surgery where the donor strip was not able to be closed because of the size of the donor site or tension on the wound. The author prepared composite grafts by slivering thin and long sections from the previously harvested donor strip. The grafts were usually 2 to 4 millimeters wide and 23 to 41 millimeters long. After composite graft placement, hyperbaric oxygen therapy was performed daily from immediately after surgery to post-op day 7. Stitches were removed on post-op day 10, and the author reports the sites healed properly. The author concludes composite grafting is a very useful approach in follicular unit strip surgery where the wound margins cannot be adequately approximated because of excessive tension after removing the donor strip.
This is Monica Bowen, and I'll be reviewing the article, How We Do It, Subcutaneous Sodium Deoxycholate Injections with or Without Triamcinolone for Reduction of Submental Fat by first author, Dr. Mitchell Goldman, and last author, Dr. Douglas Wu. Sodium deoxycholate is a non-invasive injectable, FDA approved, to reduce submental fat, but it has the expected side effect of swelling, which can occur for 1 to 2 weeks. Thus, the authors performed a randomized double-blind study to compare the efficacy and tolerability of sodium deoxycholate with and without mixture of triamcinolone, 40 milligrams per millimeter, for submental fat, and to see if it reduced that swelling effect. Volumes of sodium deoxycholate range from 5 to 8 millimeters, and both groups had similar efficacy at day 90, but the group that had the added triamcinolone to the sodium deoxycholate had less swelling and side effects. However, at day 180, the group without the triamcinolone had greater submental fat reduction, and the authors theorized that perhaps the inflammatory response could enhance fat reduction. The group that did have the triamcinolone added did experience some atrophy that did resolve on its own. Thus, now the authors recommend a lower dose of triamcinolone, 10 milligrams per milliliter, added to the sodium deoxycholate to mitigate some of the swelling.
Welcome to Beyond the Digest, offering bonus content covering surgical articles in dermatologic literature outside the peer-reviewed journal Dermatologic Surgery. Reference the episode description for publication details of the content covered.
This is Kima Tosco, and I will be reviewing hydrochlorothiazide use and risk of keratinocyte carcinoma and melanoma, a multi-site population-based cohort study out of the August issue of JAD. Hydrochlorothiazide is one of the most commonly used antihypertensive medications. However, it has known photosensitizing properties that may cause an abnormal skin response to ultraviolet light and thus is of concern for an increased risk of skin cancer in patients taking this medication. To address this concern, authors performed a multi-site population-based cohort study using administrative health databases from 6 Canadian provinces to compare the association of hydrochlorothiazide with keratinocyte carcinoma and melanoma separately by comparing to ACE inhibitors and calcium channel blockers. Patients were excluded if they had a history of skin cancer, prior use of any hypertensive medications, HIV, or solid organ transplant. Authors found no overall association between hydrochlorothiazide and the risk of keratinocyte carcinoma compared with ACE inhibitors or calcium channel blockers, although increased risks were seen with longer durations and higher cumulative doses. With respect to melanoma, hydrochlorothiazide was associated with 32% increased risk of melanoma compared to calcium channel blockers, with no increased risk compared to ACE inhibitors. This increased risk was further elevated with longer durations and higher cumulative doses of hydrochlorothiazide. The findings from the study are consistent with previous studies, and the risk of skin cancer with hydrochlorothiazide must be weighed by patients and physicians when choosing to incorporate it as part of an antihypertensive treatment regimen.
This is Yesil Kim, and I'll be reviewing an original investigation in July's JAMA Dermatology, validation of the 2022 National Comprehensive Cancer Network Risk Stratification for Cutaneous Squamous Cell Carcinoma by first author Jacqueline Stevens and senior author Emily Ruiz. The 2022 edition of the NCCN reclassified cutaneous squamous cell carcinomas into low, high, and very high-risk groups to improve prognostication and guide treatment recommendations. Based on the new risk stratification groups, Mohs or peripheral and deep on-FOS margin assessment was recommended as a preferred method for tissue processing for high and very high-risk tumors. The purpose was to compare outcomes in a very high, high, and low-risk NCCN group squamous cell carcinomas and to compare outcomes of these squams stratified by Mohs and Y local excision. This retrospective cohort study included patients 18 years or older with cutaneous squamous cell carcinomas diagnosed between 2000 and 2017 at Brigham and Women's and between 1996 and 2019 at Cleveland Clinic Foundation. Tumors were classified by NCCN risk groups per the 2022 guidelines and analyzed by low, high, and very high risk characteristics. Any tumor with one or more high and or very high risk features was classified as high risk or very high risk respectively. The outcomes analyzed included local recurrence, nodal metastases, distant metastases, and disease-specific death. A total of 10,196 tumors from 8,727 patients were stratified by the NCCN guidelines into low risk, about 3054 tumors, high risk, 6269 tumors, and very high risk, 873 tumors. The median follow-up time was 37 months for low risk, 35 months for high risk, and 27 months for very high risk tumors. In the high-risk and very high-risk groups, there was a male predominance of 65.1% of the high and 72.5% of the very high-risk tumors being for male patients. On multivariable stepwise competing risk regression analysis, the very high-risk group and the high-risk groups demonstrated significantly worse outcomes compared with low risk for local recurrence, nodal metastases, distant metastases, and disease-specific death. Mohs or peripheral and deep on-FOS margin assessment had a 35% lower risk of local recurrence, nearly 60% lower risk of distant metastases, and a 45% lower risk of disease-specific death compared with Y local excision. Limitations of the study is that this study included tumors from two large tertiary referral center cohorts and not any from community-based cutaneous squamous cell carcinomas, and the retrospective nature of the study, including the possibility of underreporting of certain risk factors since an independent review of histological risk factors was not performed for each tumor. In conclusion, this dual institute cohort study demonstrates that NCCN high and very high risk group cutaneous squamous cell carcinomas have a significantly increased risk of developing poor outcomes, and importantly, regardless of NCCN risk groups, Mohs or peripheral and deep on FOS margin assessment confers lower risk of developing local recurrence, distant metastases, and disease-specific death.
This is Tara Jennings, and I will be reviewing the research letter, Patterns of Tumor-Infiltrating Lymphocytes Used to Distinguish Primary Cutaneous Squamous Cell Carcinomas that Metastasize, by first author Sepeda Ashrafzadeh and senior author Mariam Askari. The authors first provided background that tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes, or TILs, play an important role in cancer outcome and can either be protective against cancer progression or locally immunosuppressive, leading to metastasis. Previous literature has shown that intratumoral T lymphocytic infiltrates are associated with good clinical outcome in melanoma and Merkel cell carcinoma. However, the association between TILs and metastatic risk in cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma is unknown. The authors of this study sought to identify the type, location, and density of TILs in primary cutaneous squamous cell carcinomas that metastasized versus those that did not metastasize. This was a matched case control study. The cases were cutaneous squamous cell carcinomas that metastasized to at least one lymph node or organ, and the controls were cutaneous squamous cell carcinomas that did not. Cutaneous squamous cell carcinomas were identified by querying the pathology archives of MassGen Hospital for cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma specimens biopsy between January 1, 2000 and December 31, 2018. Cases were matched to controls based on age, sex, immune status, tumor location, and Brigham and Women's Hospital cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma staging. Primary tumor specimens underwent immunohistochemical stains for CD3, CD4, CD8, and FOXP3. Two of the co-authors were blinded to case status and classified the tumors by TIL presence, location, and density. Location was characterized as intratumoral, stromal, peritumoral, and density was characterized as absent, non-brisk, and brisk. 60 patients were included. Compared with controls, the metastatic SCC cases were significantly less likely to be infiltrated by CD3 positive T lymphocytes in all locations and less likely to have brisk or absent density of FOXP3 regulatory T lymphocytes intratumorally. Subgroup analysis revealed stage T2A cutaneous squames had similar significant CD3 positive TIL findings, although these findings were limited by low numbers. There was no difference in location or density of CD4 and CD8 positive T lymphocytes between cases and controls. Previous studies have demonstrated that the presence of CD3 positive TILs and high intratumoral FOXP3 densities portend increased survival in melanomas, Merkel cells, and oral squamous cell carcinomas. This study further substantiated the possible protective role of CD3 and FOXP3, as the metastatic tumors in this study had significantly lower CD3 TILs in all locations and were significantly less likely to have an absent or brisk intratumoral density of FOXP3 regulatory T lymphocytes. Larger studies are needed to further investigate the TIL characteristics of primary tumors and may help us identify patients at risk for poor outcomes and refine the cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma staging in the future.
This is Kim Matosko, and I'll be reviewing Risk of Mortality After a Diagnosis of Melanoma in Situ by first author Vishal Patel in the most recent issue of JAMA Dermatology. Melanoma in situ is largely regarded as a precursor lesion to invasive melanoma. Despite accounting for approximately half of all detected melanomas, little data exists regarding the long-term prognosis and mortality after a diagnosis of melanoma in situ. Using CR data from the National Cancer Institute, the authors of the study sought to identify mortality after diagnosis of melanoma in situ. They first identified patients with first primary melanoma in situ diagnosed between 2000 and 2018 and divided these patients into two separate cohorts. One including only patients who had melanoma in situ and no subsequent primary melanoma, and another which also included those who later developed a second primary melanoma. These cohorts allowed them to calculate these patients' risk of mortality and risk of subsequent melanoma, respectively. From the analysis of the first cohort, with first and only primary melanoma in situ, 0.6% died of melanoma, and 12.6% died of any other cause. At 15 years, melanoma-specific survival was 98.4%, and relative survival was 112.4%, meaning that patients with melanoma in situ lived longer than the general population without a diagnosis of melanoma in situ. In the second cohort of patients, 11.8% had developed a second primary melanoma, of which 37% were invasive and 63% were in situ. At 15 years, the cumulative incidence of a second primary invasive melanoma was 8.9%, and that of a second primary melanoma in situ was 14%. For patients who experienced a secondary primary melanoma in situ, the melanoma-specific survival was 98.2%, and relative survival was 126.7%. For those who experienced a second primary invasive melanoma, melanoma-specific survival was 91%, while relative survival was 117%. Overall, the study suggests that the mortality of melanoma in situ is extremely rare and infers that patients with a diagnosis of melanoma in situ have an increased but low risk of melanoma-specific mortality and may live longer than those in the general population.
This is Yesil Kim, and I'll be reviewing the research letter in August's JAD, Number Needed to Biopsy for Longitudinal Melanonychia, a retrospective review by first author Alexandra Bender and senior author Kathleen Manava. Longitudinal melanonychia is a common dermatologic exam finding with both benign and malignant underlying etiologies. Biopsy overuse can lead to negative effects, including permanent nail dystrophy, and biopsy underuse can lead to risk of delayed diagnosis of melanomas and poor outcomes. This was a single-center retrospective review of patients greater than 18 years of age with clinical findings of longitudinal melanonychia who underwent nail biopsy between 2000 and 2022. The authors calculated the number needed to biopsy as 1 over p, with p representing the number of malignancies biopsied divided by total number of biopsies. 163 nail biopsies were performed, 34 of them, so 22%, were malignant, including 22 malignant melanoma, 11 MIS, and 1 squamous cell carcinoma. The number needed to biopsy for this population was 4.94. The remaining 129 non-cancer diagnoses included subungual hemorrhage, lentigo, benign nevus, myxoid cyst, subungual exostosis, onychopapilloma, and onychomatricoma. Most nail biopsies were performed by dermatologists and hand surgeons. In this cohort, nearly 1/4 of nail biopsies performed due to longitudinal melanonychia were found to be malignant. This is Yesil Kim, and I'll be reviewing your research letter in August's JAD, Incidence Trends of Melanoma Among Young Adults, an Epidemiologic Study in Olmsted County, Minnesota, by first author Olivia Crum and senior author Addison Deemer. A previous study conducted by Mayo Clinic found a striking increase in melanoma incidence among young adults aged 18 to 39 years of age between 1970 and 2009. In this article, the authors provide an update on the incidence of melanoma in young adults from the same population-based cohort by expanding the time period to include 2010 to 2020. The authors utilized a Rochester Epidemiology Project database, which encompasses records of the Olmsted County population of 18 to 39-year-olds with a first lifetime diagnosis of cutaneous melanoma between 1970 to 2020. A total of 422 cases were identified. The age and sex-adjusted incidence rate increased from 4.2 per 100,000 person years in 1970 to 79 to 27.7 per 100,000 person years in the period of 2011 to 2020, which is a 6.6-fold increase. There was an 8.4 increase in women and a 4.6-fold increase in men during this time. In recent years, comparing 2005 to 2009 versus 2015 to 2020, the incidence has not significantly changed in women or men. no melanoma-specific mortalities occur due to MIS. Among 349 patients with invasive melanoma, 20 deaths were documented, including 11 due to melanoma. This study demonstrated that the incidence of melanoma in men and women has stabilized over the last 15 years in this cohort. Despite this, melanoma incidence in 2015 to 2020 continues to be 8- and 4-fold higher than it was in 1970 to 79 in women and men, respectively.
This is Tara Jennings, and I will be reviewing the original investigation, Comparison of Clinical Pathologic Features, Survival, and Demographics in Sebaceous Carcinoma Patients with and without Muir-Torre Syndrome, by first author Nolan Maloney and senior author Nora Kibbe. Muir-Torre Syndrome is a variant of Lynch syndrome and is characterized by mutations in DNA mismatch repair genes. Patients with Muir-Torre syndrome present with Lynch syndrome-associated visceral neoplasms, consisting mainly of gastrointestinal and genitourinary carcinomas, and cutaneous sebaceous neoplasms, including sebaceous carcinoma, sebaceomas, and sebaceous adenomas. Previous studies have shown that visceral tumors in Lynch syndrome patients tend to be less aggressive, have a lower grade, and have less propensity for metastasis than the same malignancy in those without Lynch syndrome. The impact of Muir-Torre syndrome diagnosis on the behavior of sebaceous carcinoma has not been fully elucidated, and recent clinical practice guidelines in sebaceous carcinoma excluded Muir-Torre-associated cases. The author's objective in the study was to investigate the clinicopathologic features and survival of patients with sebaceous carcinoma with and without Muir-Torre syndrome. This was a retrospective, population-based cohort study. Authors utilized the CR17 database to identify sebaceous carcinoma patients diagnosed from 2009 to 2019. Inclusion criteria included known primary site on the skin, known surgical treatment, and complete data on cause of death and months of survival. Patients were classified as Muir-Torre syndrome or non-Muir-Torre syndrome based on a threshold score of 2 on the Mayo Muir-Torre risk score. The authors identified 105 Muir-Torre cases and 3,677 non-Muir-Torre cases. On univariate analysis, Muir-Torre patients were younger, had a higher proportion of Black patients, had fewer periocular and head and neck tumors, had fewer high-grade tumors, and were less frequently treated with Mohs micrographic surgery. On Kaplan-Meier analysis, Muir-Torre patients trended towards having a better sebaceous carcinoma-specific survival, but this was not statistically significant. Upon adjusting for other covariates, Muir-Torre status was an independent predictor of worse overall survival. However, there was no association between Muir-Torre status and sebaceous carcinoma-specific survival. Interestingly, the results of this study showed that location on the trunk and extremities was associated with worse overall survival and disease-specific survival after controlling for age, sex, histologic grade, Muir-Torre status, and treatment type. This is in contrast to previous research demonstrating a higher local recurrence rate and rate of nodal metastasis for periocular sebaceous carcinoma compared to other head and neck sebaceous carcinoma. In summary, this study showed that Muir-Torre-associated sebaceous carcinoma patients had lower grade and trended towards improved disease-specific survival. This is consistent with previous literature showing that visceral malignancies in patients with Lynch syndrome are less aggressive than the same malignancy in those without Lynch syndrome. It was not surprising that overall survival of Muir-Torre patients was worse than the age-matched non-syndromic cohort, as Muir-Torre confers significantly increased risk of other malignancy. The authors point out that given the high disease-specific survival of sebaceous carcinoma reported in this study may have been underpowered to detect a difference in Kaplan-Meier analysis.
This is Elizabeth Cusick reviewing the original article, a retrospective case series of Mohs micrographic surgery and interdisciplinary management of female genital skin cancers, local recurrence rates, and patient-reported outcomes. by first author Dr. Shannon Nugent and senior author Dr. Christopher Miller. The retrospective case series begins by providing the background that conventional excision of female genital skin cancers has high rates of local recurrence and morbidity. Few publications have described the local recurrence rates and patient-reported outcomes after Mohs micrographic surgery for these female genital skin cancers. In this retrospective case series, authors evaluated female genital skin cancers treated with Mohs surgery between 2006 and 2021 at a major academic center. The primary outcome was local recurrence. Secondary outcomes were patient-reported outcomes and details of interdisciplinary care. 60 skin cancers in total of 57 patients were treated with Mohs surgery in the study. Most common diagnoses that were included were squamous cell cancer, basal cell cancer, and extramammary Paget disease. Three local recurrences were detected with a mean follow-up of 61.1 months. 31 patients completed the patient-reported outcome survey. Most patients were satisfied with Mohs micrographic surgery at 71% and reported no urinary incontinence. 8 patients were sexually active at follow-up, and 75% experienced no sexual dysfunction. Most cases involved interdisciplinary collaboration at 71.7%. In conclusion, this is the largest published cohort of Mohs micrographic surgery for female genital skin cancers and demonstrates that incorporating Mohs surgery in multidisciplinary teams can achieve low recurrence rates and satisfactory urinary and sexual function. In conclusion, further research is needed to establish indications for Mohs micrographic surgery of these skin cancers and potentially have them become standard of care practice.
This is Tara Jennings, and I will be reviewing the research letter Predictors of Palliative Care Receipt in Merkel Cell Carcinoma by first author Malika Marani and senior author Jeffrey Scott. Palliative care is defined as patient and family-centered care that optimizes quality of life by anticipating, preventing, and treating suffering, and is recommended for patients with advanced stage cancer, as early intervention has been shown to improve quality of life by affecting symptoms, mood, and end-of-life communication. There is little information about the utilization of palliative care in patients with Merkel cell carcinoma. The author's objective in this study was to identify the disease-specific and socioeconomic characteristics that impact the likelihood of palliative care receipt in Merkel cell carcinoma patients. This was a cross-sectional retrospective study of patients with stage 4 Merkel cell carcinoma, identified using the National Cancer Database from 2004 to 2015. The receipt of palliative care was defined as surgical procedures, radiation therapy, or systemic therapy provided to prolong the patient's life by controlling symptoms to alleviate pain or to make the patient comfortable. Therapies aimed to treat the tumor were excluded. Of the 1,350 patients with metastatic Merkel cell carcinoma, 163, or 12.1%, received palliative care. An increased delay from diagnosis to surgical therapy and radiation therapy were associated with decreased receipt of palliative care. Metastases to bone and to brain were associated with increased palliative care receipt. The degree of comorbidities was not associated with receiving palliative care. In summary, the results of this study demonstrate differences in palliative care utilization by location of metastases and time to treatment for stage 4 Merkel cell carcinoma. Importantly, authors point out that while brain and bone metastases appear to be the most likely to prompt palliative care, Merkel cell carcinoma metastases to the liver is also associated with poor prognosis and should prompt early initiation of palliative care. They also point out that identifying disparities, such as delay to treatment, may help optimize palliative care utilization in the future. Of note, this analysis was performed prior to the approval of immunotherapy for Merkel cell carcinoma and may not be applicable to current practice.
This is Elizabeth Cusick reviewing the research letter, Decreased Incidence of Merkel Cell Carcinoma in the Younger Population, Aged Below 50 Years, in the United States, SEER Analysis from 2000 to 2019, by first author Dr. Alves and senior author Dr. Orange. The article begins by providing the background that the increasing incidence of Merkel cell carcinoma is a major health concern due to its malignant and aggressive behavior. However, there is little sufficient evidence existing in the younger population. This article seeks to examine Merkel cell carcinoma incidence in the United States and how distribution varies in individuals under the age of 50. This was an observational study using the SEER-18 database to identify 6,826 patients with Merkel cell. Incidence rates were adjusted to the 2000 United States standard population and 2-year averages. Between 2000 and 2019, the overall incidence rate increased by 1.36% overall, 1.21% for men and 1.31% for women. Conversely, a decrease in incidence rate occurred by 1.77% in patients less than 50 years. Although this change was not statistically significant, stratifying the data by sex evidenced a significant incidence rate decrease of 3.8% in men and increase of 1.31% in women. Declining incidence was persistent in subgroups of adults aged 45 to 49 by minus 4.04%. However, it remained stable over time in those aged 40 to 44, and data were insufficient for subjects aged less than 39 years old. Since its discovery, Merkel cell incidence has increased steadily, but these findings indicate an incidence decline in individuals aged less than 50 years old, especially in males. Although these results provide new insights for Merkel cell carcinoma, the analysis is based on only 28% of the United States population. Therefore, it may not reflect regional incidence differences. These results indicate a decreasing incidence of Merkel cell carcinoma in individuals less than 50 years of age, specifically from 45 to 49 years of age. These findings, possibly influenced by the greater use of sun protective interventions, underscore the importance of continued prevention efforts.
This is Yessel Kim, and I'll be reviewing an original investigation in August's JAD, No Difference in Survival for Primary Cutaneous Merkel Cell Carcinoma After Mohs Micrographic Surgery and Wide Local Excision by first author Kevin Moore and senior author Emily Ruiz. Although cutaneous Merkel cell carcinoma is most commonly treated with wide local excision in conjunction with sentinel lymph node biopsy, there is a lack of consensus in the optimal surgical approach for the primary cutaneous lesion. The 2021 NCCN treatment guidelines recommend a wide local excision with 1 to 2 centimeter margins with consideration of adjuvant radiation, narrow excision margins with adjuvant radiation, or Mohs with adjuvant radiation for primary cutaneous Merkel cell carcinoma. Prior studies using both nationally representative samples and single institutions have shown no overall survival benefit for wide local excision compared to Mohs. These authors sought to evaluate Merkel cell carcinoma survival for primary cutaneous tumors with no evidence of nodal metastases at diagnosis treated with wide local excision and Mohs micrographic surgery using the SEER registry from 1989 to 2015. In total, 2359 U.S. adults with primary cutaneous Merkel cell carcinoma were included in the study. 13% of tumors were treated with Mohs and 87% underwent wide local excision. 97% of patients were white, and the most common tumor location for wide local excision cases was the trunk, and the most common tumor site for the Mohs was the face. Over half of the individuals who underwent wide local excision received sentinel lymph node biopsy, whereas only a minority of those treated with Mohs receive sentinel lymph node biopsy, 15%. Multivariable Cox survival analysis for overall survival showed no significant survival difference for Mohs compared to wide local excision. age greater than or equal to 75 years of age, male gender, and no radiation treatment were associated with significantly worse survival. There was no significant overall survival difference between T1 versus T2 or higher tumors. Patients who did not undergo sentinel lymph node biopsy had worse overall survival and Merkel cell carcinoma-specific survival outcomes for both Mohs and Y local excision compared to those who underwent sentinel lymph node biopsy. There was no statistically significant difference in Merkel cell carcinoma-specific survival for Mohs compared to Y local excision. Although the study did not show a difference in survival based on surgical approach, Mohs does have other benefits. Mohs evaluates nearly 100% of the margin via peripheral and deep on-foss margin assessment, whereas standard wide local excision only evaluates a small minority of the margins. Mohs is also tissue sparing, which is especially useful in cosmetically sensitive areas or for larger tumors. Furthermore, the results demonstrate that utilization of sentinel lymph node biopsy was associated with improved overall survival in both Mohs and the Y local excision groups. Unfortunately, this analysis showed that individuals undergoing Mohs had lower rates of sentinel lymph node biopsy, which is consistent with other studies. Since sentinel lymph node biopsy is shown to improve prognostication and treatment planning, it is imperative to coordinate sentinel lymph node biopsy prior to Mohs for Merkel cell carcinoma. Limitations of the study include the retrospective design of the SEER database, so there is a potential for underreporting, there is no information on tumor recurrence, and no information on the exact margins that were used. In conclusion, the studies show that there is no significant difference in overall and Merkel cell carcinoma specific survival for primary cutaneous Merkel cell carcinoma treated with Mohs or Y local excision. However, Mohs should be considered for treatment of Merkel cell carcinoma as long as sentinel lymph node biopsy can be performed prior to surgical resection. This is Yesil Kim, and I'll be reviewing a research letter from August's JAD characterizing cutaneous malignancies in patients with skin of color treated with Mohs micrographic surgery by first author Michelle Juarez and senior author John Carucci. These authors characterize differences in the outcomes of cutaneous malignancies in patients with skin of color, including African, Asian, Hispanic, or Native American descent, treated with Mohs at an academic center from 2018 to 2022 through a retrospective study. 137 patients were included, comprising of 64 patients with skin of color with 73 cutaneous malignancies and 73 Caucasian patients matched to patients' age, sex, diagnosis, and tumor location. In the skin of color group, Hispanic patients comprised the majority of 67%, followed by Black 19% and Asian patients 14%. Majority of tumors were basal cell carcinoma, followed by squamous cell carcinoma, adnexal tumors, and DFSP. Compared with Caucasian patients, patients with skin of color had larger preoperative tumors, 1.1 versus 0.8 centimeters squared, had larger postoperative defects, 3.5 versus 2 centimeters squared, and required a greater number of Mohs stages, 1.5 versus 1.2 respectively. Additional subgroup analysis revealed that only Hispanic ethnicity was predictive of greater preoperative tumor size, postoperative area, and Mohs stages. Finally, there were no significant differences in time from biopsy to surgery or repair types between the two groups. In summary, the authors found that patients with skin of color, particularly Hispanic patients, presented with larger preoperative tumors and larger postoperative defects and required more Mohs stages compared with Caucasian patients treated with Mohs, which is an important finding to add to the growing body of literature revealing disparities in patients with skin of color treated with Mohs.
Thank you for listening to Derm Surgery Digest, the official podcast of the Dermatologic Surgery Journal. To access these featured articles, author videos, and much more, visit journals.lww.com/dermatologicsurgery. To learn more about the American Society for Dermatologic Surgery, visit asds.net.
This is Christy Regula reviewing performance and quality measure selection by Mohs surgeons in the 2020 Merit-Based Incentive Payment System by first author Christian Grunbeck and senior author Hal Feng. Medicare's Quality Payment Program, or QPP, was first established in 2012 to promote high-value care by linking physician reimbursement to various performance measures. Physicians participate in one of two tracks, the Merit-Based Incentive Payment System, or MIPS, or the Advanced Alternative Payment Models, APMs. Under the MIPS framework, which is used by most of the dermatologists, individuals are eligible for an annual payment adjustment, either positive or negative, based on their performance across four domains. Those domains are quality, cost, improvement, activities, and promoting interoperability. Clinicians participating in advanced APMs are excluded from MIPS reporting and are subject to a unique cost and quality incentive structure. Dermatologists overall have demonstrated increased MIPS engagement and improved performance since its initiation in 2017. This study aimed to describe MIPS performance and measure selection by Mohs surgeons in the 2020 performance period, which is important given the increasing potential payment adjustment, now negative 9% to positive 9%. Stated efforts by the American College of Mohs Surgery to develop Mohs-specific quality measures are in place, and the approaching transition towards a more streamlined specialty-specific incentive payment system makes this very relevant. In this study, final MIPS scores and quality measures reported by groups and individuals in the 2020 performance year were obtained from the Medicare QPP datasets. And this data was linked by clinician NPI numbers to dermatologists in the 2019 Medicare Part B provider set. Final MIPS scores from a range of 0 to 100 were correlated with expected payment adjustments among specific subgroups of Mohs surgeons. So in 2020, final MIPS scores were calculated based on quality, 55%, promoting interoperability, 30%, and improvement activities, 15%. Those were the categories it was based on. MIPS scores less than the performance threshold of 45 equate to a negative payment adjustment. Those meeting this threshold translate to a neutral adjustment, and those exceeding the threshold correspond to a positive adjustment. So during this time frame, scores were available for 8,778 of 12,018 dermatologists and 2,148 of 2,597 Mohs surgeons in the Part B provider set. Mohs surgeons predominantly submitted as groups, 51.6%, or individuals, 36.4%, and less frequently submitted through APMs, 12%. As determined through final MIPS scores, 77.4% of Mohs surgeons exceeded the performance threshold and will receive a positive payment adjustment, and only 0.3% will receive a negative payment adjustment. There were 22.3% who will receive a neutral payment adjustment. ACMS members, who accounted for 53.1% of Mohs surgeons in the sample, were also more likely to meet the exceptional performance threshold than those that were not, 71.5% to 59%. At least one quality measure related to dermatology or Mohs surgery was reported by most individuals, 92%, and dermatology groups, yet less frequently by multi-specialty groups and hospitals. General non-derm-specific quality measures may be easier to report, conveniently assessed by office staff, and possibly promote general well-being, but they are not directly related to dermatologic care, and it's unclear from this data how or whether they can improve care for this patient population. Importantly, there are a growing number of additional dermatology and Mohs-related quality measures reportable through dermatology QCDRs, which are qualified clinical data registries, that are not available in the public Medicare data sets. Specifically, ACMS members are eligible to report through Mosaic Registry, which in 2020 offered 10 measures assessing adherence to Mohs appropriate use criteria, management of perioperative antibiotics and non-opioid pain management, utilization of emergency services after skin reconstruction, and rates of surgical site infection. Additional measures created in 2022 assess utilization of anatomical mapping to avoid wrong site surgery and continuation of anticoagulation therapy during office-based skin cancer resections. ACMS and non-ACMS members can also report through DataDerm, which is the AAD's QCDR, which also contains measures that assess dermatologic surgery. Although utilization and performance on these QCDR measures is not publicly available, the fact that most surgeons reported non-QCDR measures suggests there may be utilization barriers or lack of familiarity with QCDR reporting. Furthermore, most surgeons in multi-specialty groups and hospitals rarely reported any dermatology or most specific measures, suggesting those in large group may lack autonomy in measure selection. Further studies will be needed to comprehensively assess utilization of these QCDR measures and any utilization barriers that exist. But I do think that it's worth looking into some of these QCDRs to identify more specific measures to our practice.